Today is Sunday, June 10th. I'm Sarah Lang with the Oral History Program at UW-Madison. I'm talking with Sue Gozen, book artist, UW alum, and co-founder of Dude & Ake Press at the Kohler Art Library. Sue, you grew up in Neenah, Wisconsin. Can you talk about your family life there?
I didn't completely grow up in Neenah, but my family have lived in Neenah for, since the late 1840s, and I come from a papermaking family, and all of my cousins or aunts and uncles or whatever are in some form of papermaking. My next-door neighbor invented Kotex, I think I mentioned that. So I grew up hearing about it all the time, and I thought of it in terms of tonnage, and I thought of it in terms of bottom line. I didn't think of it in terms of art, but I did grow up hearing about it.
And can you tell me a little bit more about growing up? You said you lived partly in Neenah. Like, how old were you when you moved away?
I actually moved to Neenah when I was 10 years old. So my dad worked for Kimberly-Clark, another paper company. So I was born actually outside of New York City. And I think I was exposed to a lot of art and culture at a very young age. And then eventually made it back to Wisconsin.
Sure. And do you remember going to any of the museums in New York City?
Yes, very much so.
Can you talk a little bit about maybe one of your first experiences there?
Well, I do remember going to the Metropolitan Museum, and I remember how huge it was. I don't think I'd ever been to a cathedral before, but I had that feeling walking in. And it was a very different experience than it is now because there were no people there. It was just this big, amazing place with all of these beautiful things. So that's probably the most vivid experience.
And do you remember when you were a child, did you draw? Did you paint? How did you get interested in art?
My aunt on my father's side was a painter, and my father grew up in Green Bay, actually, and they had a big old-fashioned Victorian house with, you know, one of those enclosed porches, and to get away from her seven children, she would paint in her porch and close the door, and when I would come visit, I'd go in and she would show me the studio and we would talk about her paintings, so she was definitely an influence.
Okay, and then where did you go to high school and college then?
I went to a girls' boarding school outside of, well, actually in Troy, New York. It's called Emma Willard School, and it's the oldest girls' school in the United States. And actually, Emma Willard is considered the founder of women's education in the United States. And I happened to have, was lucky enough to have as my principal, William Deedle, who was really interested in women's rights. Not exactly feminism at that time, but encouraging women to be very independent and fulfilling their potential. He went on after Emma Willard to become head of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and his worldview hasn't really increased because he always had an incredible worldview. And as a matter of fact, I'm going back this coming weekend for my 50th class reunion, and Mr. Deedle, who is, I don't know how old he is right now, but he's coming back because he loved our class so much and is very excited to hear about what all of us have been doing.
Very nice.
Oh, and then for college, I went to Beloit College, actually.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Beloit was very attractive to me because, well, there's a lot of family ties, actually, to Beloit College, and my older sister was there, my brother-in-law. We have a lot of family members who've gone to Beloit. One of the things at that time that was very unusual, and I think there were only a couple schools like Antioch that had this kind of program, to both get to have overseas education as well as to have a semester where you worked in your field, an internship. At that time, it was very unusual. And so it attracted really interesting students, and of course this was the late 60s, where things were pretty wild anyway.
So did you end up going somewhere as part of your education?
Yes, I did. I went to, it's going to sound boring now considering how amazing the world is, but I went to London, and it was great, and we just had our small class. It was communications class, and because it wasn't aligned with one school, we took a communications class at the London School of Economics, which of course is an extraordinary school, and we studied I Love Lucy and how American popular culture and communication was tied to the TV, American television, and all of us, you know, laughed through the whole thing. We also went to Pinewood Studios, where they made the James Bond movies, and they never had students come out, and they thought that we were, you know, serious, maybe UCLA students or something, I don't know, but they opened all their doors, we met all their movie stars, we sat down to these huge luncheons with butlers serving. I mean, it was really wild. We also took music classes at Goldsmiths. We did, the most important thing, actually, the head lecturer at the Tate Gallery, Tate Modern, was our art history professor, Mr. Bradbury. And he had developed the art therapy program after World War II for the returning vets. His class was so extraordinary about understanding where artists are coming from in terms of making their work. It would take me a long time to go into a lot of details, but it really was amazing. And we didn't have written tests, they were oral tests, which as Americans, wow, that was a new thing. So it was such a good class. I shouldn't admit this, but I couldn't take any art history classes after it. They just, you know, looking at a bunch of flat slides on a screen, no comparison to hearing somebody, as we walked through the galleries, talk about the work, talk about the artist personally, and understand both historically what led to their vision of contemporary art, as well as personally the emotional issues and how that combined with the two things. Anyway, he was great. So that was a great experience for Beloit College.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And when you returned to Beloit, did you do an internship as well?
That one was a weird one. I couldn't quite get one, so I can't remember the story. I ended up working at a store here in Madison.
Okay.
You know, it was fine. I learned actually quite a bit about selling things, which is never a bad thing for people to learn.
Yeah. And so how did you decide to study art at UW-Madison, get your MFA here?
I was always interested in art, you know, from my aunt. And when I first started taking classes, they were in the painting department. And it was at a time, Linda Benglis was just starting her career at that time. And I remember people used to pour blobs. Linda was pouring blobs at that time. And it was kind of a do-your-own thing. And I felt like I wanted more instruction, so I wandered over to the printmaking department, and it was on fire, and it was really interesting, and we learned, we got real tools, and I don't mean that literally, but tools for how to learn how to express ourselves and communicate, and the teachers were great. All of them were just amazing. It was a very exciting time, and I think the print department here is I didn't know it was this acknowledged print department. I just wandered over there, but I can see why it was. And the students were absolutely as exciting as the teachers, and the visiting artists were as exciting as the whole group, so it was great.
Could you talk a little bit more about the tools that they gave you?
Well, I think it's almost like learning drawing. You're learning how to express yourself, as I said, which is different from a do-your-own-thing and you pour latex whatever on a floor. I mean, that is too, but it's more structured. And you have to learn how to produce something. And there's something about the process of printmaking that is very journey-like. Probably all art-making is. But it's very stepped, and the steps are very clear. So I was very grateful to Warrington Colescott, who was not only my teacher, he ended up being an incredible mentor, because not only did he teach me everything I ever wanted to know about etching and engraving, which he did, and he was very good, but he mainly, once he saw that I was a hard worker, that was the most important thing, he really didn't make judgments per se, it was mainly how hard he worked. And once he realized I was a hard worker, then whatever I did, fine. So that by the time I ended up getting very interested in color photography, which was not popular at that time. So again, I couldn't find a niche. And he said, fine, just do color photography, even though you're in my etching class. And then eventually it led into papermaking, and I didn't bring any etchings to my final critiques, and he didn't care. He just knew, you know, I was following my muse and working very hard at doing that. And I you know, would consider that one of the best lessons I learned in terms of being a good teacher.
And who else did you study with while you were here?
Certainly Jack Damer, mm-hmm. Bill Wiggy. You know, mm-hmm. Bill Wiggy really epitomized kind of this wonderful freewheeling experimental approach to making art. Very, very open, less structured. So you had to be a little further along, I think, in your image making mm-hmm. To work with him and get the most from his advice and his instruction. But they were just very experimental times, so he was really open to all of it. And then, of course, Walter Hamady, learning how to set type and to make books. And then when he introduced me to paper making, it clicked. Not that I didn't like everything else. It was like mm-hmm. being a kid in a candy store.
So. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
About Walter Hamady?
Yeah, and paper making?
Yeah, so I was interested in my husband, who helped me co-found Dieudonné, was a writer, and I thought it'd be fun if I illustrated some of his writing. Mm-hmm. So I went to Walter's class, and I learned how to set type and how the structure of sewing up a book. And then kind of as we got through some of those classes, he said, well, okay, it's very expensive to print an entire edition of a book. So if you want to, you can make your own sheets of paper. Just go to your grandmother's linen closet and get her permission to take some of her old linens, and this is how you make paper. So he cut up the rag, put it into a laboratory beater, which is what's called a 1.5 pound beater. So you weigh out 1.5 pounds of rag. You have to cut it up into pretty small pieces, like 1 inch by 1 inch. Mm-hmm. And then you add water. It's just a tub with a wheel that has bars that hit a bed plate that has bars, and then it grinds the rag into pulp. So I learned it, and it was very funny because it was like a closet paper mill originally in the type shop. He literally opened a closet door, and I don't even know how he did it there when I think about how much water is involved with paper making, but we did. And then while I was still a student, they moved it down to a basement somewhere over there, mm-hmm. So we had a lot more space. And as I often tell people, I got so engrossed in the process that I would sign up at 9 o'clock at night because we had 2-hour slots, and I was pretty sure nobody would come after me. And then I'd work from 9 at night until 9 in the morning because I couldn't stop experimenting. It was so fascinating to me. I'm going to go blank. He taught stage lighting at the time. He worked at the Metropolitan Opera, mm-hmm. very famous lighting designer who I think eventually died of AIDS. But he was teaching in the theater department. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, something about art history, I just couldn't take art history from slides anymore. So I thought, well, what is art all about? It's really about light. I'd really like to get a better understanding of light and how it works. Different colors mm-hmm. are separated and then work together. So I took his class, and he was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And he would fly back and forth between Madison and New York. I don't know how he did that in snowstorms and stuff, mm-hmm. because he would have to be on stage doing the lighting at the Metropolitan Opera. And also his whole vision of how you take what you love onto the bigger stage, and of course one of the biggest stages is the Met Opera. So he's a very inspiring teacher, and I was very lucky to take his class. And he asked us all to come in for a private conference and tell him what we were going to do once we graduated. And by that time, I already knew, there's no question, that I want to go to New York and start this papermaking business, because if artists knew they could do all these different things, of course they would be interested. So, I can't remember his name. Anyway, so I went in for my conference, and I said, okay, this is my plan. And he listened to it for a few minutes. He said, okay, we're finished. You know what you're doing. which is great. Of course, it gave me a lot of confidence to hear that. And then I just remember when I got my MFA, some of my last graduate seminar critiques, Warrington was so behind whatever I did that, as I said, I didn't show any etchings, even though I love etching. I was so involved with papermaking and still color photography, doing it on my own. But that's what I showed, and they said, great, you know what you're doing. So that's the best advice I could offer to any young student. Just follow your muse and work hard, because that's what my teachers told me to do.
So in your lighting class, can you talk a little bit more about what you did in your lighting class?
Oh, I don't know anything about theater or the stage, nothing. But we had to, I guess it's called the egg crate. You have to climb on top of this incredible structure that hangs over the stage. And then you have to direct the lights and the gels according to whatever is going to be performed. So just learning about light and shadow and how the colored gels would mix to create, you know, something that feels calming, something that feels the exact opposite, violent or whatever. It was great. It was you know, the best instruction I could get, I think.
So it sounds like you talked about color theory then in the class.
We talked a lot about, but it was color theory through light, which is quite different from color theory through art making. And if should I take a moment to digress on what I learned later in my life about
that?
So I didn't take color theory as a student, which was probably a gap, but maybe it was okay. But at any rate, about a decade ago, I was working on a book project, a limited edition book project, which is something that I started with Walter at the University of Wisconsin, that whole my path in life, not only making paper, but making limited edition artist books. So I was working on a new project with the Catalan artist Frederic Amat, and also with Robert Wilson. Speaking of lighting, I don't know if you know who Robert Wilson is, the performance artist.
No, I don't.
Look him up. He's extraordinary. There's no other master like Robert Wilson when it comes to lighting, actually. But we ended up not using his lighting talents for this book. He has a very curious form of calligraphy that we used. But anyway, Frederic was doing the images, and Frederic chose the Pulitzer Prize winning, oh no, excuse me, Poet Laureate of the, oh no, he was a Pulitzer Prize winning, but anyway, also Poet Laureate of the United States, Mark Strand. And
oh,
he,
I like him.
Oh, well then you'll love the story. So, and it's almost hard for me to talk about my whole experience with him without crying, because it was so touching. At any rate, about 10, oh, at least 10 years ago, so Frederic and I had known each other from early days at Girona. He lived back in Barcelona. We were working back and forth, and he said, Sue, you really need to look up Mark. He's teaching at Columbia. You know, you should get together. So I said, yes, yes, I'm always too busy. Anyway, so he Mark got in touch with me and said, hey, you're on 36th Street. I'd like to come down and meet you. I said, great. So he came down, and we had this big studio on 36th Street with all this papermaking and art making going on. And then an archive with a lot of books and quite a few books that I had done. So in talking about the project that we are about to start, even though they were previously published poems, and Mark didn't have too much to do in that way except to say, yes, you can use my poems, but he's still really curious. So I showed him a number of books that I had done with other artists, and he was really curious. And then I showed him around the studio, and he got really curious. And I said, well, and he's a very nice man. And I said, I'm going to be, I think that was on Friday, I said, I'm coming in on Saturday and Sunday, because I'd often go in to do experiments for projects that were coming up when it was quiet and I could work by myself. And I said, well, come on in. Tomorrow I'm going to be making some paper. I can show you how to do it, and you can play around a little bit. And he said, okay. Came in the next day. I showed him some basic stuff. And we always have, like, dozens and dozens of colored paper pulp, containers of colored paper pulp, from various artists who are classes or whatever, and people are always welcome to use them. We don't throw them out. They get really stinky, then we have to throw them out. So there were all these different colors, and he said, do you mind if I use some of these? I said, no, no, go ahead. So he started, like, and he said, can I mix them up a little bit more? And I said, yeah, they're free for everybody. So I went off to do some things. I came back, and he had what I'll call as a palette, you know, some colors that he wanted to use. And they were the most beautiful colors, combination of colors. And I just, you know, was looking at them. And then I started helping him and showing him how he could work. Okay, he was in his 70s at this point, and he took to it like a fish to water, you know. And he was really having fun. So by the end of the day, I knew I was coming back the next day. I said, well, do you want to come back tomorrow? And he said, oh, could I? I'd really like to do some more. So I said, fine. This started, so years, over the years, we would get together on average once a month for a weekend. And I would prepare a lot of times the base sheets, but I'd never touch the colors. And he would never mix up, oh no, I shouldn't, every once in a while he'd mix up his own color. But usually he would just take whatever garbage pulps were around and mix them up. And finally, after about, I don't know, 5 years, no, maybe not that long, maybe 3 years, because I was really curious. I said, you know, really stupid comment. I said, gosh, your mom must have had a great sense of color. And he, you know, always had a twinkle in his eye. Very interesting man. And he said, oh yeah, you know, she did, as a matter of fact. I said, you know, you have the most beautiful sense of color of anyone I've ever worked with, and you're a poet. I don't quite understand this. And he said, well, you know, I did get my MFA at Yale. And I said, oh my gosh. And then, oh no, I'm going blank. Who is the most famous German artist who did all the color experiments? Oh, and his wife, Albers, Joseph Albers. Mm-hmm. So, and he said, as a matter of fact, Joseph Albers was my teacher. Joseph Albers did all the most famous color experiments that have ever been done. And he used his students to do them. And he said, so Mark was his main color guy for all these experiments. No wonder why he knew why this color and that color would sing.
Uh-huh.
And so I really paid attention from then on for the next 5 years when we would work. I mean, not that I wasn't before, because I'd never worked with anyone who really understood color. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'm finally, you know, at age, I won't tell you how old I was, but finally at age whatever, I'm getting like the best color theory lesson in art, in an art form versus light, pure light. Anyway, so that was a very fun experience. And actually Mark had given up the visual art muse because the poetry had taken over. And he always wanted to get back to it again. And just, so this was, I didn't know these things. I just thought he liked to play. And he did these beautiful things. He had his first one-man show that sold out at a gallery in Chelsea at age 79 of all the experiments and collages that he'd done with me. And then he had his next one-man show that sold out also. And they traveled to China and all kinds of things. And I would be working with him now, but because we became dear friends, oh, I don't have that book with me, the last book I did. But he passed away shortly after that. But anyway, so that was my color theory lessons over many years.
That's a great story. Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing. So I guess kind of going back to studying in Madison, and you were talking about working with some of the different professors here, I wondered if you could kind of remember who some of the other students were at the time. Like, did you collaborate with any of those students at the time, or was that later?
Yeah, actually collaboration's always been very important to me, mm-hmm. in any form. The person I had my MFA show with, Jody Shields, who mm-hmm. has now become an acclaimed writer. She always was a dual, well, actually I know a lot of people who are writers as well as artists, mm-hmm. but a great visual artist, and she got a gallery almost right off the bat. And we had a dog pack. We had a pack of friends, a big pack, actually. We partied as hard as we worked. So she and I, as a matter of fact, for our MFA exhibition, we had our exhibition up, but then we had a big party out in those outdoor areas, and we had lots of friends from different departments, the Far Eastern Studies, all kinds of things, and a lot of our friends were also performers, so we wrote music and had a big performing group of dancers and singers and musicians And we had, you know, big garbage cans of alcohol. And that was our MFA party that went on till all hours of the night. So it gives you an idea. We had a lot of fun. And so besides Jody, Paul Wong, who was an excellent lithographer and student of Jack Damer's, one of his prize students, and also Joe Wilfer acknowledged Paul Wong's incredible talent and had him work at his studio out at Jones Road Paper Mill.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, was that Bill Wiggy or I just went blank? Anyway, Joe definitely championed Paul. And Paul, after, in 1978, I went out to New York in 76, and Paul, I invited Paul to come out in 1978, and kind of the rest is history. He became Giudice's master papermaker, extremely talented artist in his own right, but also an exceptional collaborator, which I have learned over many decades, some of the qualities it takes to become, you know, a really fine collaborator, and he is that. Ruth Lingen, of course, was a Madison person. Jane Hammond, who's an acknowledged artist. She shows at Gallery Le Long in Chelsea, and she and I collaborated. Those are her hands in this picture. Here we go. But she was a student at that time, and her, I don't know if they were married or not, but Art Shade was a teacher. A sculpture teacher, and they built the beater for the first beater that we had in New York.
Okay.
And it goes on. Kathy Grove and Larry List, and we had a huge group. Nancy Mantor. This is whenever you do this, you forget like your closest friends or whatever. So there were probably 40 of us that were really quite good friends, and everybody was quite. Ambitious too, quite serious. So, and as a matter of fact, since I was the first, I think, of the group to come out at that time to New York, I put almost everybody up, came through, you know, slept in this, actually they all slept in a soundproof beater room before we got the beater, which was perfect in New York because it's very noisy. But lots and lots, and it's, this group is still, we're still very close, very, very close. Mm-hmm. And it, such a gift to form friendships like that last your whole lifetime. For the sake of friendship, of course, but you know, when you move to a scary place like New York to have each other's support, I'm trying to think if anyone's kids have married each other, but certainly, you know, we've all had kids together, we've gone skiing together with the kids, you know, it's like it goes on forever. And it really is lovely, and we help each other out in our art careers also. We still do that too.
So were you kind of encouraging people to come to New York, or did people just find themselves attracted to New York and you were there and then they looked
probably
up?
More the latter. Not that I didn't encourage people,
yeah.
I did, but if you know, New York is one of the major marketplaces for art in the world, so it's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, you could go, nowadays you can go to many other countries, but if you're American and you don't speak German or I was going to say French, but France is not quite as well. London has a really amazing art scene, but at any rate, New York's a natural. I mean, Los Angeles now more than it used to be, but at that time it was like New York or bust.
Well, I was reading your essay and you were talking about how the time period when you were in Madison was ripe for experimentation in art. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, it was, since I'm a 1960s hippie generation, and I think the thing that I remember first, perhaps, are the civil rights movement, and the various marches and I was not quite as directly involved as some of my sister who went on the marches, although I did go to the first Black Panther convention in Chicago, and I may have been the only white female. It was very intimidating. I didn't stay for that long. That was 1968. But, you know, so there was a lot of, like, let's remake the world, a lot of empowerment. And then, of course, the Vietnam War started, and I was definitely female, but in the middle of that. And so whether it was family or friends, most of the people I knew did not support the war, and were doing whatever they could, if they were young,
mm-hmm.
whatever they could to get out. Oddly enough, I did know one or two people who went over and served. One old, very dear friend who became a Marine, and I was in college at Beloit, he would be writing me these letters from the front, and, you know, I'm embarrassed to say, of course, I really didn't understand what he was writing to me at all. But he made it back, thank heavens. But, you know, everybody was concerned about the draft. And at the same time, you know, it was like a time of revolution, you know, Woodstock. I mean, it really was like that. We thought we could reinvent the world, which was great. And we were such a big generation. There were so many of us that it was very, very powerful. And, of course, even though I was in school in the art department in the mid-70s, there was still, you know, there's still a lot of residue from all of that. And still a feeling of great experimentation that I think the amazing optimism in this country as the world was rebuilding after World War II, everyone looked to the United States as having the answers. And when I was in school in London, which was 1970, the Beatles had just ended, which was like a big deal. But, I mean, people would, you know, I was talking going to Pinewood Studios. These are, you know, major movie producers. They were turning to us to, like, answer questions about what the world was all about now. I mean, and they did it very respectfully. I don't think they were making fun of us. So it just was very, very different. And now I travel quite a bit, and I go to Burma to learn, you know, take ox carts out of Mandalay to learn about bamboo paper making for the gold leaf paper that they make to worship, as well as I've spent quite a bit of time in India in recent years and taught in Egypt just before the Arab Spring, et cetera, et cetera. So I spend quite a bit of time in quote, developing countries. And even though there are a lot of struggles that there as they boom, come really fast into the 21st century, the feeling of optimism and opportunity is not unlike what I felt in the 60s and early 70s. It feels so different here now. It almost feels in the United States the way I would feel when I was when I was in London, or I traveled quite a bit in Europe. They were just struggling after the war. They were trying to, you know, their horizon was closer. The opportunities were more limited. I don't know why, but it feels that kind of heavy feeling is what I feel in the States now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I was in school here in Madison, I mean, you know, the world was our oyster.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we could do anything. It was very optimistic. And that we were convinced, of course, we had the confidence that we had solutions, the right solutions, that would be good, that were democratic, that were really for everybody. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was wondering, kind of going back to your collaborations with
mm-hmm.
Some of the UW students, were there ones while you were in school that you particularly remember that you'd care to talk about?
Well, I didn't. When I was in school, I was really trying to find my own voice.
Sure.
So they weren't so much specific art collaborations,
mm-hmm.
I don't think, at that time. They were more self-expression collaborations, which,
mm-hmm.
or AKA a party, you know, but a very
sure.
creative, because we used to have big costume parties.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're pretty elaborate, actually. So it was a lot, just a lot, everything was creative. Everything we did had a creative element to it. But I wouldn't say, they weren't like how I think of collaboration now in a more formal sense. In terms, it's still, And I often talk about the books that I do as that I'm building a sand. It's a new sandbox when I start. So I build the sandbox, and then usually I start with the artist rather than the writer, but sometimes just the opposite. So I'll invite one playmate, and we start working together in the sandbox, and then we invite another playmate, and it's a very very creative process. Usually there's one person who leads, and I consider that to be the visual artist.
Okay.
And actually recently at this show in New York, IPCNY, we had an incredible panel, and it might be online pretty soon. And my co-curator, Amina Takahashi, conducted this talk with Richard Tuttle, mm-hmm. who is quite a well-known and accomplished artist in New York. And we at Judenay, and many people have, that's why we had a lot of different collaborators, have worked with him. And it's a very good conversation about collaboration. But usually it's the artist who leads the way, and it's an artist who's very open to, and not threatened by, people offering suggestions,
mm-hmm.
But still having a very clear sense about what might be intellectually or experientially very interesting, but not quite doesn't quite fit their vision. Certainly, I would say the best artists, I was going to say the easiest, usually the best are the easiest artists because they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're not necessarily demanding, they just know what they're doing. And the best artists are the best collaborators. They're great because they're really open to all kinds of suggestions, but are very efficient at editing what's not good for them, but what is just right for them.
Could you talk a little bit more about how the artist works with the writer, if there is a writer involved?
Yes, a perfect example. Remind me to bring, I didn't this time, because it's actually, I have to plan for it, really plan for it. But I'll bring back a Leslie Dill book and a William Kentridge book for sure, and a Mark Strand book that are fairly easy to bring. So in the case of Leslie Dill, who's another wonderful contemporary artist, we worked with the poet Tom Slay. And most of her career has been built on the poetry of Emily Dickinson. So in terms of visual artists, she, more than many, is very tied to words, poems, literature. In this case, she wanted to work with a guy instead of a dead woman, a live guy, a very live guy, Tom Slay. And she chose a poem that, it's not warlike, but it has a, Emily Dickinson's, you know, very introspective,
mm-hmm.
And this poem is not. It's like, whoa, very strong. So because they're good friends, Leslie said, Tom, do you mind if I, not rewrite your poem, but do you mind if we print it kind of differently than the stanzas you originally set the poem to? And he said, yeah, do whatever you want to. And you'll see she like pulled it apart so that the pages of the book are these very vivid lines or phrases from lines. And then, oh, I'm sorry. Oops. Matter of fact, I'm so sorry. I really do need to watch the time. So I'll have to end in 4 minutes. At any rate, she pulled apart this poem and made it her own. She chewed it up and threw it back out again, and it's beautiful. Wait till you see the book. It's great. And Tom loved it, too.
Mm-hmm.
He just thought it was wonderful. I did do a book with Warrington Colescott and Jerome Rothenberg, and they had been collaborators, and Jerome Rothenberg is an incredible collaborator and writer of books as well as poetry, books about books. And so the two of them had a lot of fun. And in that case, Jerome wrote the poems and Warrington responded to them. Actually, that was true with Leslie too, now that I think about it. But, oh, I should bring that book out too. Is that Improvisations? Is that here?
Yes, we have.
Okay, because that has the condoms in it that my dear Warrington, who I love, said, you know, these poems are kind of juicy and, you know, there's a lot of kind of evocative imagery in the poems. Let's make some paper that kind of goes along with that. And I said, sure, Warrington, what are you thinking about? And he said, well, could we put condoms in the paper? And I said, well, Yeah, you can put anything in the paper, but I'm not sure if it will work. But I'm always willing to try something, you know. So I put some condoms in the paper, and sure enough, they were really, you know, pretty interesting. And if you, I mean, they look like a pattern, but if you think about it, you can tell they're a condom. In the same way that you find condom, a dirty condom, like on the street or whatever, and that was exactly what he wanted. So Warrington was thrilled. He said, yes, that's great. And I said, okay. So then I had to make an entire edition of condom paper for this edition of the book. And it just so happened that I was quite pregnant and showing. And when I went to the pharmacy to get boxes and boxes, I can't remember. I had to get hundreds and hundreds of condoms for this thing. And so I got, you know, hundreds and hundreds. And they had to be, they couldn't be lubricated because then that wouldn't work in the paper, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I'd had to do all these tests. But I just remember going and buying these condoms and being really pregnant and the expression on this guy's face, like, lady, I think it's too late, you know. And then it was really funny because when we made the paper, we double cooch, which means you put down one sheet of paper and mm-hmm. then you can collage elements and then you cooch the second sheet of paper on top and it holds everything together. It seals it. But the condoms would blow up. When they like get all this air and then, mm-hmm. you know, they form these kind of balloon type things in the paper. So we had to puncture every single condom. Okay. There I was pregnant, puncturing all the condoms. I should have, you know, taken some pictures or something because it was funny. Anyway, yeah, so there's a lot of give and take, even if the... even if it's pre-existing literature, for example, there's still, if the person's alive, mm-hmm. there's still a lot of give and take back and forth. And I'm one artist, William Kentridge's sister, Eliza Kentridge. I've done some books with William and I've done some with Eliza. And Eliza's a poet as well as an artist. I should bring out all these books actually because it's easier to show this. So in that case, she didn't change any lines of poetry, of course, or anything like that. But the book that, or she could have, but she's a poet. But the book that we did together were three poems from a selection of poems that she had done. And I don't think I've ever, I take that back. With Mark Strand, I also did his writing and his imagery. And it is really fun to work with someone who can do both. It's, you know, quite amazing, actually. Mm-hmm. And in Eliza's case in particular, the poems were about her mother, and they're beautiful poems about her childhood in the 50s. And I'll bring the book. And the images have this kind of 50s feel to them. And it was really nice because we would, you know, talk about certain images that were, and especially because it was about her mother. I don't know, it was so personal. And even William, I got a chance last year to speak at a conference in Johannesburg, a book conference, mm-hmm. and I was staying with the Kentridges in Johannesburg, and it was really fun because Eliza was there, and while I was at the panel, William was on one side and Eliza was on the other, and it was really fun to talk about brothers and sisters and how, I mean, he's so masculine and she's so feminine, and yet they both had this incredible skill at drawing. It's phenomenal, which is very South African. They really know how to draw. And staying with them also was their father, Sir Sidney Kentridge, who was visiting because his kids were there together. He actually lives in London now, and he was knighted, I guess, because of all the amazing work that he and his wife did to take down apartheid. So it was this incredible experience to talk about books and talk about the kids' books, because especially because Eliza's was about his wife. And, you know, anyway, so I love to do things with families like that or make families, and it becomes a very rich experience. I can't remember. I just got off track. But actually, I'm going to have to go. Yeah, I'm sorry. My dear Warrington, who I love, said, you know, these poems are kind of juicy and, you know, there's a lot of kind of evocative imagery in the poems. Let's make some paper that kind of goes along with that. And I said, sure, Warrington, what are you thinking about? And he said, well, could we put condoms in the paper? And I said, well, yeah, you can put anything in the paper, but I'm not sure if it will work, but I'm always willing to try something, you know. So I put some condoms in the paper, and sure enough, they were really, you know, pretty interesting. And if you, I mean, they look like a pattern, but if you think about it, you can tell they're a condom. In the same way that you find condoms, a dirty condom, like on the street or whatever, and that was exactly what he wanted. So Warrington was thrilled. He said, yes, that's great. And I said, okay. So then I had to make an entire edition of condom paper for this edition of the book, and it just so happened that I was quite pregnant and showing. And when I went to the pharmacy to get boxes and boxes, I can't remember, I had to get hundreds and hundreds of condoms for this thing. And so I got, you know, hundreds and hundreds. And they had to be, they couldn't be lubricated because then that wouldn't work in the paper, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I'd had to do all these tests. But I just remember going and buying these condoms and being really pregnant and the expression on this guy's face, like, lady, I think it's too late, you know. And then it was really funny because when we made the paper, we double cooch, which means you put down one sheet of paper and then you can collage elements and then you cooch the second sheet of paper on top and it holds everything together. It seals it. But the condoms would blow up. When they like get all this air and then, you know, they form these kind of balloon type things in the paper. So we had to puncture every single condom. Oh, yeah. There I was pregnant, puncturing all the condoms. I should have, you know, taken some pictures or something because it was funny.
So today is Friday, July 20th, 2018. I'm Sarah Lang with the Oral History Program at UW-Madison. I'm talking with Sue Gozen, UW alum, paper artist, and co-founder of Dudenay Paper Mill, and we're at the University Archives and Steenbach Library. So Sue, last time we were talking about some of your collaborations. We talked a little bit about improvisations, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about this project called Intergenerationality that you were a part of. And it paired artists from a couple of different generations. Could you tell us about that project?
Yes, I'd be happy to. It was basically combining some of the, not the earliest pioneers, but earlier pioneers of hand paper making, which many of us came out of the Walter Hamady tradition, rag tradition of paper making. Combining those of us from that time with a younger generation. And in my case, I met Lara Henderson at Haystack when I was teaching there, and she was a part of the MIT Fab Lab. And the Fab Lab was a laboratory that MIT has put together and sent out to the world in many different places so that people who don't normally use laser cutting and contemporary technology in their art making can learn about it and use it in their own art making. So there we were at Haystack with all these old crafts, whether it's clay or paper making or glass blowing, and we were able to work with very trained people at the Fab Lab that they had, portable a Fab Lab that they had there. And Lara and I started experimenting with watermarks using laser cutting, and it was very interesting. So later on, when Tatiana Ginsburg, was asked to organize this particular project for Hand Paper Making Magazine for their portfolio, she asked me if I wanted to participate, and I said yes. And I thought Lara would be the perfect person because she was so well trained in very contemporary technology, although she had a wonderful background in the book arts, studying with Haiti Kyle, who's a brilliant off-the-charts bookbinder and bookmaker. So she's a great person to work with. And Lara has incredible experience in all the different technical techniques, old and new, actually, because she has been very involved with AS220 in Providence, Rhode Island, which is a not-for-profit that supplies artist studios and fully equipped technical studios so that artists can make their own work, not in a school situation, but in a not-for-profit situation. She was delighted, and I went to visit her, and I asked her if she would be interested in doing the watermark part, and she said yes, that would be great. And I had been reading about the experiments by the Japanese water scientist Masura Emoto, who, I don't know, have you ever heard of him before?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, he's kind of off the charts a little bit, but a bona fide Japanese water scientist, and in analyzing water, the purity and the content of water from all over the world, he and his assistants started noticing that the water crystals were really quite different and would respond to the environment in which they were being tested. So what would happen is that as the frozen water, there's a split second where it goes from frozen water, or excuse me, from ice to water, and it forms crystals, not unlike snowflakes in a way. And they realized that the water crystals, they were taking photographs of these crystals, that if they had music on, I guess initially they had classical music, Mozart, whatever, that the crystals were very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But if someone put on some heavy metal music, they were no longer crystals. They were like muddy, murky images. So they started doing all these experiments with how water responds to the vibration that it's around. And
mm-hmm.
I won't go any further than that. It's very fascinating. It's been very hard to repeat these experiments, but I just love the idea that things are that sensitive. And because watermarks, which is what I was very interested in, are very sensitive and a part of the papermaking process, which is at least 70% water. And of course, we're born at least 70% water. And then of course we dry up and become more prune-like. But you know, the planet is 70 to 80% water. We are 78 to 80% water. And the thing that I'm most interested in are these watermarks, which are very sensitive and very descriptive. So I thought it was kind of perfect to work with some of his imagery. And I was delighted that Lara did not think I was insane, so an insane person from an older generation. Instead, she thought it was really interesting too. So we went through, her job was, we went through the images that you can get them online. We went through the images and tried to pick out the ones that were most precise and appropriate for making into a watermark. And I'm not going to get into that because it would take me a long time to describe how certain images more easily can be translated than other images. So we've tried to find just the right image, and we tried one, then we tried another. And Lara was, it was a lot of work to try and translate these images. And then finally, we were both going through them, and I noticed the one, the image that came from John Lennon's Imagine was the simplest and clearest. So I said, okay, let's try and use Imagine. And so she worked on that. And I wish I'd brought that out with me, actually. It's too bad that I didn't. So what we did is we reproduced this particular crystal that is representative of the song Imagine. And it's quite beautiful. And it's a combination of a cotton image couched on top of a translucent water type color that mm-hmm. is a translucent abaca. So that was our contribution to this portfolio.
And how long did that process take for you to kind of conceive of that and then to have the final product, you know?
A long time,
yeah.
Longer than it should have.
It sounds very complicated.
It is pretty complicated. And a lot of it is, because in order to... this would take me so long to explain, and I really would need samples to show you. But to translate an opaque image into something that is illuminated through light, and so what happens is, in terms of opacity versus light, you're almost reversing how you think. I don't know, you know, it's too hard for me to explain it, but at any rate, we had an awful lot of fun reading about these experiments because they're fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoying trying to figure out. It was a big puzzle. And then once we figured out the image, I kind of dealt with the papermaking aspects of it, trying to make sure that technically, because she wasn't really a papermaker.
Mm-hmm.
And then to addition it, we did a lot of the auditioning in New York City at Dieudonné, and then I finished up some of it in my own private studio because it was a much bigger project than we had intended, but it worked out pretty well.
Well, speaking of watermarks, I know you brought another piece along, the Chuck Close piece. Do
yes,
you want to
yes.
bring that out and talk about that?
Sure. Yes, well, actually, I don't have to bring everything out
no,
again
because
I showed
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, the work that we had done with Chuck Close, which of course started with Joe Wilfer, his initial experiments, which were kind of like paint by number, but with paper pulp, colored paper pulp. And they were, the initial ones were really quite simple and I won't say crude, but quite simple. And there's something wonderful about the simplicity. And then they got very complicated where we would have a combination of, and I'm not sure if Ruth already spoke about this, but using something that looks like a, cookie cutter type puzzle pieces in which base colors were put on, and then there would be layers of clear stencils that would be put on top of that with many more layers of colors to build up the image, and then it would go into the press, and then it becomes one piece, one integral piece. It's very different from printing, where you're always putting on the surface of an already made sheet of paper. This is building up with the pulp. So because of my obsession with watermarks, I was curious about working with Chuck making a watermark, and I asked him if he was interested, and he said yes. So we took a daguerreotype of a photograph that he had done, a self-portrait, and I took it to Crane and Company, and they are, unfortunately, they're owned by Nina Paper Company now, but for hundreds of years, they were their own company, and they have been making our currency, our American currency, since before we were the United States of America. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, and they have a wonderful museum, paper museum in Massachusetts, because they really are bona fide paper makers, even though they started out as hand paper making and it went into commercial paper making. At any rate, they designed the watermark devices for currencies, and I'm sure they do this still, even though they're under the auspices of Nina Paper Company. Ironically, I come from Nina, Wisconsin, but anyway. So they make the watermark devices, and what that means is that they impress into metal mesh so that the pulp is uneven. Some of it is thin and some of it is thick, and that's how you form a watermark. And then that is sewn commercially onto a dandy roll. But in hand paper making, that mesh is sewn onto a wooden frame to make an individual sheet of paper. So I went to talk to them, and they pulled out drawer after drawer of all these wonderful watermarks that they had made for African countries, you know, that had rhinoceroses and lions, and then there, you know, the European countries with various kings and queens. And every time I would start to ask a detailed question, they would usually say, no, we can't answer that, because watermarks were developed as an anti... Well, originally they were developed to brand the paper. So a paper maker, that's how they would sign their paper. Or they would... a name was included in some way to say that this paper was for this customer. It was a specific custom paper for a customer. But eventually it became as an anti-counterfeiting device.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this technology was not shared, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a wonderful story about how during World War II, the Germans were making, of course, a lot of counterfeit English money. And they weren't able, by simply the printing, because the printing was so well done, to determine if it was counterfeit or real. The only way that they could determine that it was counterfeit is by analyzing the mineral content in the in how the different parts of the water had formed the currency itself.
Okay.
And so the combination of the watermark and the kind of water that they that was used, they realized, no, this could not have come from an English river. It had to have come from a German river, which I think is pretty fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, to get back to the currency grade. So the currency grade is very sophisticated, and it's a light and shade watermark. So you have gradations. It's not a line watermark.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite sophisticated, and it's traditionally it was made by carving wax, and then a male and a female mold were cast from the wax, lost wax method, and then the mesh was heated up so it was soft, and then pressed between the male and female mold to create the design, the pattern that
okay.
was made. So nowadays it's done photographically instead, but it's basically the same concept, and that's they would not answer my questions as to the details, because I think if you're pretty good at making etching plates or polymer plates, for example, for letterpress printing, that you could probably figure out a way to do it yourself,
okay.
But probably not to the degree that they do it. At any rate, they said yes, they were curious about doing this themselves, and the watermark expert who helped me was someone named William Blake, which I loved the fact that his name was William Blake, and he was lovely. He's a very William Blake-like person,
mm-hmm.
very sensitive, and we went back and forth for months and months trying to get it right, and then finally we got it right, and then the next part, as even with the Imagine watermark that I was talking about, is getting the pulp just right. You get the watermark image just right, but then you have to get the pulp itself just right. And so that was a whole nother process. And actually the people at Crane had real doubts as to whether or not we'd be able to do it, because they're really accustomed to how paper is being made in a commercial context. And there's a certain kind of pressure and suction and vacuum that happens in that kind of equipment that doesn't happen in hand paper making, of course. But nonetheless, all these things have been made by hand way before machinery was invented.
Sure.
So I knew that I could figure it out somehow. It took me a little while, about 3 years of development,
okay.
and then we were able to do it. And we added, in this particular case, what you often do with watermarks is you add some pigment, because it helps define the image a little bit better than a pure white
sure.
Image.
Interesting. Have you done other projects like that since?
Lots of them.
Yes.
Yeah, I really, it's my favorite. That's, as a matter of fact, in graduate school with Walter, we had to write a research paper, which was great, very
uh-huh.
smart. Walter was, you know, an incredible teacher. And my graduate research paper was on watermarking.
Okay.
But I was interested, and that's when I talked a little bit earlier about J.J. Plank, and well, it was in Appleton, now it is in Neenah, Wisconsin, which is my hometown, and they make watermarks, but there's also a transparentizing medium that is printed on top of just regular paper that makes the paper where it's printed with the transparentizing medium look almost translucent.
Okay.
So it's a fake watermark.
Mm-hmm.
It's a printed ink. So I did a lot of experiments to try and understand back in graduate school, you know, what happens when you work from inside the structure of the paper, which is really what watermarking is, versus on top, which is any kind of printing.
Mm-hmm. And for your other projects, did you continue to work with Crane, or how are you handling
this? No, not recently. And I'm trying to think, no, because actually with laser cutting now, you can do some pretty sophisticated things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a way to create that is something that gives the effect of a watermark.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still working with the pulp, of course, but instead of subtracting the pulp, which is kind of what you're doing with a watermark, having less pulp
mm-hmm.
in some areas, what you can do is add on,
mm-hmm.
but you're still working with the concept of light coming through translucent and more opaque areas. But you start with very, very thin paper and then add on. So I can't remember if you've seen this or not, but when we first worked with William Kentridge, for example, one of the things that we did was to make a suite of drawings with him, and he did the drawing, and then we had, because he loves traditional technology, then we had wire watermarks designed, fabricated, that were like his drawings. They were sewn on top of the surface of the laid mold, laid lines, or the old-fashioned lines. Most paper before Baskerville was laid lines, which I have a feeling I can go really deep into all this stuff, so mm-hmm. I apologize, just stop me. But when you think about the fact that paper making went from east to west,
mm-hmm.
and as they were devising how to make paper in the east, something that looks like a bamboo screening was used to make sheets. Well, that concept moves west, and bamboo doesn't grow in the west. And so I think it was replaced with these rods that were sewn down, because they kind of look like bamboo, you mm-hmm. know, but it's a different material. And then it was Baskerville, who was, of course, an incredible type designer and printer, who said, oh, this is really a problem, because all those lines actually are thinner areas. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing very fine printing, you'll lose the dot of an eye as it hits that thinner area. Do you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it's so funny, because you turn these things around over time, and laid lines indicate handmade paper. So very often, as I was talking about the transparentizing ink that's printed,
mm-hmm.
so very often laid lines were printed on top of the surface to make it look like expensive handmade paper. Even,
okay.
You know, it's like this crazy thing. But at any rate, so we did have laid line molds, and we do actually, Judenay, laid line molds as well as wove mesh molds. And the wove mesh is very even. It's like, you know, there are no differences really. The laid lines, you can see these wonderful, very thin laid lines in there. And William liked the old-fashioned look of the laid lines. And then we sewed on these wire watermarks. And then, so we made the sheets, and inside were the watermarks. You really couldn't see them. You just saw it like I showed you with the Chuck clothes. You just saw a sheet of paper. And then what he did is we took the same pulp, exactly the same pulp,
mm-hmm.
and we put it into a squirt bottle, which you could squirt it out, and it, you know, you squirt paper, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And he would draw with the squirt bottle on top of the surface of the freshly made sheet. So that, and then when it was all dry, he designed a table that's backlit. So the suite of drawings is inside a table, and you turn the table on, and the sheets go from just three sheets of paper lying in a table to these wonderful images that are actually the thinnest layer, of course, is the watermark.
Mm-hmm.
The next layer of opacity is just a sheet of paper. And then the next layer is, next couple layers are the addition of pulp drawing that's on top.
Interesting.
So instead of working with, it's just basically translucency and opacity. But the way that was done traditionally was always in a watermark form. But now we're working with it in a much broader way, kind of going backwards and forwards in terms of thickness and thinness. And we do that a lot in a lot of different aspects of paper making. As another example is, because it's, I don't know if I mentioned this or if somebody else has, but you make a sheet of paper by hand. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. dipping a window screen into some pulp. You pull it up, the water goes down, the fiber's left on top. It's still 90% water, really. And then you flip it over on top of a felt. And mm-hmm. a felt is traditionally it was wool, because the vegetable the plant fiber would not stick to the animal fiber. That's
okay.
why you would do that. And then you can multiple couch, which means you pull another sheet, and you can couch it exactly in the same place, or you can make a smaller sheet and couch it on top of that sheet. But you can keep on going, 20 couches. It's probably, who knows how many, you could just keep on going depending on how thick or thin the pulp is, so that you really can this, you know, this concept of thick and thin, you really can draw with opacity and translucency very easily. And then you can also, between these layers, and a lot of the artists that we work with at Judene work in this capacity, collage elements of various kinds in between the two sheets, or the third sheet or the fourth sheet. And as long as the paper can make contact, I guess it's kind of like pressed flowers or something in a way,
mm-hmm.
It will glue to itself. It's literally like skin.
Okay.
And you can't peel it up. You can't like literally peel it apart. It is skin. And that, and it's kind of like, you know, having a splinter stuck in your flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And then the flesh goes over it, you know. It's in there forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can work with that concept to do some really interesting things. It's like an archaeological dig, actually. And people do carve into these layers of of pulp and added material of some kind.
That's really fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about how the wire watermark works when you were talking about
sure.
that?
Sure. Okay. Do I have that? I was going to take a bobby pin out. But all it is that, okay, so in hand paper making, and it's actually, you can translate this into commercial paper making too, but let's stay with hand paper making. So you have a rectangle, let's say that's your paper mold. And usually it's, in Western paper making, it's a wooden frame.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that wooden frame is a screen mesh. So it really is like a, you know, window screen. And then if you sew, if let's just say a bobby pin, but any kind of wire shape or whatever, a wire shape and a heart, a wire, you know, whatever you want to do. And it doesn't have to be wire, but we'll start traditionally.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally it was wire. You just sew it onto the surface
of the mesh screen.
Okay. And then you will have, it's kind of like, what are they called in photography? Is it photograms? It's kind of like, well, I know, maybe you don't know that, but at any rate, so you'll always have that bobby pin in every single sheet of paper. And you won't necessarily see it when it's just sitting on top of a table, for example. But as soon as you hold it up to the light, like most paper, or a lot of it, is watermarked. And get, you know, like currency, get accustomed to holding it up to the light. And it's really interesting. There's a whole world inside there. So that's what a simple wire watermark is.
Okay.
I thought about bringing, I mean, and I thought, oh God, so don't bring out everything. But one of the first things I did when I left Madison, I was still very involved in being the artist myself for books that I was doing. And I did a book of Emily Dickinson poems that I illustrated. And some of the illustrations, what I did, and I have to go back and do this again, because now when I look at them, I think, wow, how did I do that? But fairly large for a watermark, like an 8.5 by 11, you know, typewriter paper size watermark image within a larger sheet of 18 by 24. You fold it over and you have that watermark, you know, in the center of one of the pages. And all I did was take contact paper, you know, that you buy it. Do they even have Woolworths anymore? Anyway, you know, like a Michael's Crafts or whatever it is, you know, contact paper. And I cut out the designs that I wanted. And again, remember when I was talking about layers. So if I wanted it thinner in certain areas, I would put on a couple more layers of contact paper. So I was able to cut out a very precise image. These were of rooms, and they were supposed to be, you know, windows of the soul, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
With doors open and windows open and things like that. And it's and actually, oh, I don't want to get into too many technical things, but I kind of like, how did I do it that big? I mean, I think I can figure it out again. Because it's hard to have the pulp have enough strength to form an even, you know, you go from thick to thin, and it's if it's all thin, that's fairly simple, not that simple, but simple. All thick is easy.
Yeah.
But within the same sheet, so the sheet's like this big, and then the watermark is like that. to go from thick to thin and to control it. It requires a lot of patience, but they're wonderful. So that was just contact paper blocking out the even flow of pulp. That's really all that you're doing. And the simplest way, as I said, you know, bobby pin or any kind of wire you sew it on. But, you know, the more we play with it, and this is what's so much fun working with papermaking creatively, is that all these were traditional techniques that we had borrowed from the craft. And, of course, the craft really was the commercial technology of its day.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes something antiquated, and then it's called craft, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, just playing with that concept, because they didn't have contact paper. But now I do this all the time, where I just cut out some mylar in the shape that I want.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to, like, worry about, oh, is the contact paper sticking enough? Is there enough stick? You know, and I'd spray adhesive to make sure that everything was stuck down. Or, like, with the wire, the mesh watermark, or the sewing it correctly so it was beautifully sewn. I mean, I can't tell you how tedious that is. Now, I just cut out the mylar, and I slap it down on the wet mold, and there's such an incredible suction that happens naturally between the surface, because of water, the surface of the water on top of a wet mold, and the you know, how smooth that mylar is, that I can, it doesn't fall off. You know, I thought, oh, it's going to fall off, but no, it just sticks. So, you know, the more you play with it, the wider the range, and the more flexible it all becomes. But that's because we're working with things in individual problem-solving cases of making art, instead of trying to make thousands of sheets of paper that are exactly the same. It's a different thing.
I like that you mentioned problem solving, because when we get to talking more about the lab grant program and working with different artists, I would like to hear more about that.
Yeah, it's all problem solving.
But you also brought another work that you were showing me, and could you talk a little bit about that one?
The William Kentridge book.
Yes, exactly.
So personally, of course, I'm a University of Wisconsin student, which means that Warrington Colescott and Bill Wiggy and, of course, Walter Hamdy were all incredibly important teachers to me. And this is a book that I published a few years ago, and I still publish as Judenay Press, which is separate from Judenay Paper Mill, although I definitely am involved. I started both and am definitely still involved with both. But because I love books, I've just kind of continued doing these on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I often describe them as each collaboration is like building a sandbox.
Mm-hmm.
And you start with one friend and then two of you invite another friend, and that's how it works. And certainly that was the case with William Kentridge. I had known him from Judenay Paper Mill and some of the work he'd done there. And then I met him another time after a lecture that he gave, and when he mentioned a couple of the poets that I admire a lot. And so I said, William, do you want to do a book? And he said, sure. And so, as I mentioned, that we spent 3 years just reading poetry, which was really fun with an artist like William Kentridge to meet at a different museum every time and just sit down for an hour or two at the Met or the Frick and read poems and decide, you know, which ones to finally pick. And we ended up picking the poems of the only female Nobel laureate, and I'm not going to say her first name because I'm so bad at it, but her last name is Szymborska.
Mm-hmm.
And we picked some of her poems. And it was towards the end of her life, actually. William, as always, was working on many different projects at the same time. And some of these images you can cross-reference with movies he was making at that time. But the images were actually made for the most part. Let me see if I can find one. What he often does for a lot of the work that he does, whether it's movies that he makes or opera sets that he does, he will do a drawing. You can see the drawing in the background. And then he puts a still life in front of that. And that's the first start of the image. So you have two realities right there. And then he'll start working on top of that. So what we did, Randy Hemminghouse and I brought copper plates with a lot of these images that he had taken to him. Like this image in particular is just dry point, actually. So this was a copper plate that we brought in. He right there did the image while we were all working together. And he is so facile in a good way. He knows what he's doing. That we were throwing copper plates at him like frisbees. And he was working so fast that we almost couldn't keep up. At any rate,
go ahead. Can you tell us what the name, the title of the book is and when you did it?
Okay, the name of the book is Receiver. Mm-hmm. And was that 2006? I can't read upside
yes.
down that
mm-hmm.
well. Okay. So it was finished in 2006, but most of the books that I work on, I would say, take a good 3 years.
Okay.
And it's really a year of putting together the ensemble of people working together, the sandbox, as I said, mm-hmm. and then figuring out who's going to do what. And very often I start with the artist. Not always, but often start with the artist, mm-hmm. and then we pick a poet. And then for me, all my projects always start with the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Most book artists, I don't think, really think about the paper like that, but of course for me, it's the paper. And then, so we start building, and again, it's always working with opacity and translucency, because that's my great interest. So here's mm-hmm. another photogravure. In this case, this is just it's a photogravure of a drawing and the still life. We went back and forth with, this is the same fiber, it's called abaca, it's the banana family. And with almost every plant that grows on the planet, you can make paper, and it's all different, so you can imagine how many different kinds of paper you can make. But there are only a few fibers that have been found by different cultures working over centuries that seem to adapt well to different purposes and are strong and last for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so cotton, for example, the mulberry in East, and then it moved towards cotton in the Middle East, and then into flax or linen as you get into from the Middle East up into Europe.
Okay.
But there are other fibers too, like this abaca, which is fabulous. And you can see how, depending on how you process it, not only is it different in terms of opacity,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of hardness and softness, it has a very different feel. And you can hear the difference between, and it's exactly the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I love to play with the nuances
mm-hmm.
of the subtleties of each fiber. And again, here are some more of the images that are the photogravures. So this one is just, this is just dry point also. This has got a little, I think I can find some that literally, I can really tell which ones, sometimes I can't tell which ones have dry point or which ones have some kind of work inside the photogravure. This one is just dry point.
And so this one is actually, the image is printed
on the translucent.
Yes.
And this was not the first time, but the first time that I did this in depth
mm-hmm.
in terms of printing on this paper, the way it's been processed, so it's very translucent. It is extremely, when I say extremely, difficult to print on.
I believe it.
And at one point, this printer, Randy Hemminghouse, who is a genius, he's wonderful, I called him up and I said, well, so what's going on? He said, I don't know, I'm at the hospital. Because he was having heart palpitations. And I thought, oh my God, I don't want him to die trying to figure out how to do this. But I won't, it would take me too long to explain how he did
sure.
this.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a very different quality.
Uh-huh.
There's definitely, you know, it's, and then to have this translucent layering
mm-hmm.
of the images, to have that dream sequence, and to, you know, you can see it from the ghost of it, because the whole point of the poems is a discussion, that's a very prosaic way of saying it, but it is talking about using your imagination, how these images, this poetry comes from imagination, comes from inside yourself, inside your world of imagination, your fantasy, and then you make it manifest. And so William was kind of mirroring that whole discussion through this description of layers of very poetic images.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into images that are much more concrete and narrative of how you make those images manifest and real. And as we go through, and you can hear as we go through these the poetic images in praise of dreams. So it's this wonderful conversation about where inspiration comes from and how for the artist and for the poet, it starts inside the head. Oh, this is a perfect example of, okay, here is a photogravure of a photograph of a drawing with a still life, and then the dry point is done on the surface. So you can really see that, how it goes right out to the edge of the plate.
Mm-hmm.
Along with that, and you can see William working in his studio, he's actually making his movies. This is how he makes his movies. I don't know if you've ever seen them. Go online if you've never seen them. They're literally mind-blowing. All of his work is incredible, but his movies are shocking. And he grew up he lives in the family home he grew up in Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. And his father, Sir Sidney, and his mother were instrumental in taking down apartheid. And so he grew up in a household that was under threat, actually. They're very well-known lawyers in their world, and they fought hard, and they won. So William and his siblings, you know, got the ringside seats to see how you change history.
Mm-hmm.
And the courage that it takes and the determination. And, it, you know, talk about an honor to work with somebody like this. I mean, of course, he's a well-known artist, but it's not just that. He watched his parents change history.
Mm-hmm.
And when he, a few years ago, he was asked by Harvard to do the Norton series, and it's a series for poets usually. Occasionally they'll ask a non-poet to do it, and they asked William to. And of course his work is very poetic. And he called up his father, who now lives in London. That's a long story. His father was in his 90s by then. And his father had actually taught at Harvard after he had done the work he felt he needed to do in South Africa. And he called up his dad and he said, "Dad, guess what? Harvard asked me to do the Norton series." And there was a long pause. And then his father said, "Do you have something to say?" I wish anything. It's like, wow. And the fact that William started the series at Harvard, he had started every lecture. There were six or seven of them. And he started everyone telling that story. And it's so great. And then, I could tell you so many William Kendrick stories. But I was very fortunate because last year I was asked to participate in a book conference in Johannesburg.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked with William's sister, Eliza, who's a brilliant poet and artist, both.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was invited to stay at the family home with all of them. And their father came from London because he wanted to be part, you know, he loves his kids and he's an exceptional man. And so William and I were talking about some projects and then we pulled out this book and I had William on one side and Sir Sidney on the other. We went through the book and I just kept on remembering that comment, "Do you have anything to say?" So, and he's really a gentle, lovely man,
mm-hmm.
very smart at 96. I will never be even close to his intelligence in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, here he is at 96. But very vital and vigorous still. And I said, "Would you mind if I ask you a question?" So I blurted out the story about, "Do you have anything to say?" And I said it because I realized what a nice person he was after
uh-huh.
spending some time with him, because it's such a terrifying comment for a parent to make to a child. So I said something like that. And he said, "But, you know, of course, do you have something to say? You need to think about that." But he said it in a way that was like an encouraging,
mm-hmm.
not not like, do you have actually have anything to say to anyone? Mm-hmm. So anyway, I was glad that I got to get to the bottom of that terrifying comment. Anyway, so here is Reality Demands, this poem, and you can see how here's reality.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is, this imagination, this poetic imagination becoming manifest. And the other thing that's going on in the poems is that it's going from being so inside yourself and your own imagination, and then it's coming out into the world. It's being born. It's becoming physical, manifest in terms of art. And then these poems go, this is the ball, and mm-hmm. it's almost like the astronauts in a way, seeing our planet from afar. So you start, it's micro to macro, mm-hmm. the whole book is. And then you're going out into the universe and sharing, you know, this creative energy. And this is Under One Small Star. This is incredibly poetic about how here we are, you know, in this huge universe, the wonder of being in this huge universe. And these images, if you can see this, those little dots going around, William was going crazy because there was an ant infestation in his studio, and he didn't know what to do with it. So, being a very clever person, he thought, So he drew a drawing in sugar water on the floor of his studio, and the ants lined up and marched along and made the drawing, and then he filmed them. And then everything he does is in black and white. Of course, he grew up in a very black and white world.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's always playing with positive and negative black and white. And so as you can see in this image, he reversed the ants from being black to white, and now they become stars
mm-hmm.
in this, you know, universe. And this is paired with this poem about going out into the world. And here they are as ants. But you can't, you know, you kind of go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fun. And then here's an image of, he's not there anymore. It's negative, the negative, and there's the empty studio. The fun part about working with William, and he really is this way, he's very poetic. It's not linear. It's
mm-hmm.
not logical or rational. It's intuitive and it's poetic. And because so often these books are cut up for the images,
mm-hmm.
We were concerned about that. So we made up a last image that shows all these different aspects of how he works. So here's the drawing in the background, the still life in the foreground. There's William actually working it, and then some dry point drawing that's on the surface, so that hopefully people won't tear up the book
mm-hmm.
and let it stay whole. So that, you know, was needless to say, an incredibly fun project, which is why all of them are really fun. And it really is, all of it is problem solving. All creative collaboration is problem solving. And one of the things that I love to talk about to funders who are interested in funding Dudene is that when, I don't care if it's little kids or big kids or whatever it is, whenever they can come in and especially work with handmade paper, it is such a generous medium. It's like just stuff. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's not like clay, it's very different from clay, but still, it's just this, you know, you're playing in water,
mm-hmm.
and people say, decades, I'm not an artist, I can't draw, da-da-da-da-da-da. But we say, well, just make a sheet of paper. So it's so simple, you know, they make a sheet of paper, and then we say, here's some squirt bottles, so here's some red and some blue and some yellow. You know, just squirt it down, or put your hand on top and squirt around your hand, whatever. And all of a sudden you have these people who say, I'm not an artist, making all these wonderful things, and then
mm-hmm.
of course it's dried and they get their sheets of paper or their artwork to take home. And it's very gratifying, and I think it really does build people's self-confidence in problem solving, because anytime you do a creative exercise, it you know, builds that muscle memory of there's probably a solution I haven't thought of. You're not in a corner. You can always turn and there's another way to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sue, let's talk a little bit more about that. I know that Dudenay's lab grant program is with, they work with artists, a lot of them who are like mid-career, so they're not just starting out, but paper's a new medium for them.
Exactly.
And so I was curious to know how you, and even in your own projects with the press, how do you kind of help an artist that you're collaborating with translate maybe what they want to accomplish or even let them know what's possible in paper? How does that work?
It is a translation. And very often you have to go to the artist studio and you really need to look at, let's say they're a painter, but you need to look at their drawings. You need to look at their prints. How they use materials, how they layer their concepts, and then it really is a translation process. And I will never be a translator, you know, in languages, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's similar. I mean, in terms of translating like a fine novel or whatever. So you don't do it literally, you do it poetically. And the key is to, it's just, it now it happens so organically for me that I actually go into these big art fairs and I get overstimulated immediately because I just start translating like all this work right away into our medium. But I'll, you know, going back to opacity and translucency, for example, you know, so all art is light, right? So you can think of it that simply in a way that, for example, I've never worked with James Turrell. Do you know who he is by any chance? Okay, well, he's Mr. He's a god. At this point, he works on a God scale, but I look at his work. You know, they're huge sculptures, but they're basically light and color. And I think to myself, okay, I know how to make these beautiful. I mean, absolutely gorgeous, translucent colors. They sing. It's like music almost. They sing, and you know, all I need are the shapes to make them in that will for his composition, and I can help deliver the materials that will make those shapes sing and become a choir. But it's, you know, so everybody's different, and very often, for example, like Arlene Sheckett, I don't know if I brought any materials about her. And did I, or did you go online, that show that I, that Mina and I, okay, because if you went online, there's quite a bit of information there, but Arlene Sheckett is an artist whose reputation is really growing more and more, which is great. That's another thing that's very exciting, to work at Dudenay and to work with emerging artists. Doesn't make any difference what age we're talking about, usually younger, though. And they're working out ideas, and you help them work out their ideas, and you do this over decades, and you watch them mature, and you all together learn how to explore this medium together and become more and more sophisticated. I mean, certainly with Chucks that happened. You know, they were, it was a simple concept that had the ability to become very sophisticated, and it did over time. And then I did this other, you know, strange thing. But so like Arlene Sheckett is, was in that show, which I'm so glad I went over to look at that museum. God, that museum would be perfect for this show. Perfect.
And while you're talking about the show, let's say it's the paper print American Hand Papermaking 1960s to today, right?
Correct,
and,
yes.
And where was that?
At IPCNY, which is the International Print Center of New York, and it's probably the most prominent not-for-profit gallery about prints that, you know, celebrates the print world. So these are all people who are very familiar with paper, although, again, they're usually thinking about the surface, not the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And this was the first exhibition that they ever had, which is kind of amazing when I think about it. The first exhibition that they've ever had where the focus, it wasn't entirely on handmade paper, because we really did want to show how paper evolved out of this incredible marriage of paper and print, because they're just naturals. And it really, paper was invented about 2,000 years ago, and then 500 years after that, printing became integral to life. I mean, there was printing before, but it wasn't integral to life. And then the rest is really human history. It really is, until the computer, until the internet. So it's kind of fabulous when you think about it. I often talk about these concepts, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself. But I do feel that when a new technology supersedes an old one, the old one, I often talk about artists go to the flea market of technology to find out the inherent value of a discarded technology. And certainly that happened, like in lithography, it had been used commercially to make images for newspapers, and then offset took over from stone lithography. So stone lithography became an artist's tool.
Okay.
And the same thing has happened in paper making, and now in printing and paper, and the book arts, of course. You know, I don't think the book arts would have flourished the way they have for the past similar amount of time. I mean, there have been, you know, certainly the arts and crafts movement, there have been periods, but now the book arts, I mean, it's just unbelievable what's going on in the book arts. And it's because, I'm sure, of the internet. The internet has taken on that, you know, that the ox burden, the yoke of the utilitarian aspects of communication, so that the art aspects are freed in a certain way. And so this particular show, we wanted to show how papermaking was a passive partner to the printing process, various printing processes, and it eventually started evolving. Really, I mean, certain decorative techniques or commercial techniques, like watermarking, which was a commercial technique, of course, but there are all kinds of decorative techniques that were certainly invented in Asia and Japan, beautiful, you know, Japanese papers that you can think of. But they were done in a decorative way, not in terms of self-expression, the way an artist would use that same technique. So it was really in the 1950s, and you can read this, I don't need to repeat it all, but it was really in the 1950s that one artist in particular, Douglas Howell, who is a brilliant printer, engraver, you know, all the book arts, and then papermaker. And once he got into the papermaking, he just, like, wow, you can do this with it, you can do that with it. So he invented our vocabulary in a way. And actually, I can't remember if I've forgive me if I have talked about this, but so Douglas Howell started inventing all these techniques. And then Lawrence Barker, did I talk about this? Lawrence Barker went to visit Douglas Howell and took a weekend workshop, and then went back to Cranbrook, and that's where Walter was in school. And he introduced this small group of students, printmaking students, to papermaking. And then the rest, you know, was kind of history. But so the show shows just a sampling of that, of the key people who kind of took to it. And then it shows when it leapt out, when the paper became the active sole performer, if you want to think about it that way. And I can't remember if I mentioned this or not too, but I often think of papermaking as being feminine and printing as masculine.
Oh,
because the printing goes on top of this support system. And papermaking is so tied to nature, even though you think of it as like, you know, where are the plants? But actually the plants are there. They're inside that fabric, you know. And it's a very natural process. Certainly if you do any kind of Asian paper making, you're very close to the harvesting the plants and cooking the plants and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And And it's very generous in that way. And so right around, and I'm maybe stretching this a little bit, but I don't think so. I lived it. So the same time that feminism was really coming to the fore in the United States was also the same time that papermaking, that this passive support for printmaking was becoming not so passive anymore, and then a sole performer. So I do think of them as that it's interesting that it was happening at the same time, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in talking about the history of all of this, it does remind me a little bit about the first North American Hand Papermakers Conference in Appleton that Joe Wilfer organized. Were you there, and could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was incredible. Joe, you know, I'm sure Ruth talked about Joe quite a bit, and, you know, just an amazing personality, very talented, really fun and adventurous, and he realized that it was time for the papermakers to get to know each other, so he organized the first, it wasn't an official conference, I don't think, because what evolved out of that is something called the Friends of Dart Hunter. And has anyone explained any of that?
No, we haven't talked about that.
All right, then maybe I'll talk about it just a little bit. And so the Dart Hunter was the American who, a William Morris type in the sense that he set his own type, he designed it, set it, printed his own books, and realized that what he was missing was fine handmade paper. So he went to England and got some paper makers, brought them to the United States, tried to set up two paper mills, went bankrupt each time. This was in the 30s, trying to set up something like hand paper making in the 30s. Anyway, it didn't quite work, but he got so fascinated by the process that he started traveling the world to all the outpost places where paper making, which it was taking place all over the world, and all these different ways, and with different plants that grew in someone's backyard, you know. And so he documented, and it really was the demise, in a way, of the craft, of the old craft. And it's great that he did this. And he collected a lot of, like, paper molds, all kinds of things that were used from all over the world. And so he had this amazing collection called the Dart Hunter Collection. And originally he gave it to MIT, and then MIT gave it to, what was it called? Because they've changed their names. The Paper Chemistry Institute in Appleton, Wisconsin. And it just, you know, kind of was abandoned, this kind of historic collection that was really abandoned, because these were all commercial paper makers. They weren't really interested in, you know, how people beat mulberry back whenever, although they should have been. But at any rate, so those of us who got interested in hand paper making, which Joe definitely did, realized that there was this amazing collection, you know, not that far away. Nobody really paid attention to it. So he organized for a group of us to come and take a look at the collection, and it was the first time that many of us met each other. And these were, again, the students of the students. They were Walter Hamady students. Eris Catrullis was another, I believe he and Walter were students of Lawrence Barker's at Cranbrook at the same time. Tim Barrett, who's another person who teaches at the University of Iowa. At any rate, so Joe got us all together, and people started saying, "Oh, gee, what do you call that when you do that?" Oh, okay. And then we started creating our own vocabulary for different techniques and just comparing notes for the first time. And it was also, at least for me personally, it was fun because I got to meet Richard Minsky, who had just started the Center for Book Arts in New York City. And he was very curious about paper making, but really didn't know anything about it. And I said, and by that time, I knew that I wanted to go to New York to start a paper making facility. And so I met Richard, and the Center for Book Arts and Judene have been friends since. And we do a lot of collaborative things together. We have over, you know, many decades now. So it was definitely a coming together of people, hand paper makers. I would say not, many of the people were coming out of some kind of printmaking tradition,
mm-hmm.
bookmaking, prints. One person, Garner Tullis, who had trained separately and was self-taught from the University of Pennsylvania, started the experimental printmaking workshop in California, and he was working with major artists like Louise Nevelson doing cast paper, so relief casting as well as three-dimensional art. So he brought that into the mix, and it was great. And you know, Joe was the perfect ringmaster, literally a ringmaster, to introduce us all to each other. And you know, he continued to do that for the rest of his life.
And then can you talk about your making your way to New York to found Doudene?
Sure. So I don't know, just the light bulb went on. When I was here at the University of Wisconsin, it just seemed so obvious to me that if artists could make, even if just making their own custom sheets of paper,
mm-hmm.
because if you actually go back in history and look at the drawings of various artists, for example, Seurat, I don't know if you're familiar with his beautiful drawings. They have a certain quality to them that it's different from the paintings, but they have a, it's almost a smoky quality to
okay.
them. And he had paper made specifically so that he could get that effect.
Okay.
He knew exactly what he was doing. It wasn't store-bought. And
mm-hmm.
not that I knew that at the time when I was a graduate student,
sure.
but it was quite obvious to me that, boy, you know, even at like a slight tint, if you liked a little rose in your color or,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a color to your paper or whatever, or a slight green or whatever it was, that you might want to do that. And then, of course, if you wanted to create in the paper pulp, and because you needed certain kinds of equipment, most people really wouldn't know about any of this. So we had researched some of the historic equipment. We knew about some of it from my class here at Walter, but we had to go a lot deeper in terms of research. And it was good and bad to move to New York. New York is extremely expensive.
Mm-hmm.
The city was almost bankrupt at that time, so Soho was very inexpensive, relatively speaking. The best place that we could find was the fifth floor loft of in Soho, which you don't really want to put something with water and drains on the fifth floor when the neighbor below is a painter, an oil painter.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to learn the hard way about certain things. For example, once we finally got all the equipment in there, I can't remember if I mentioned this or not, but we tested the equipment, and there's a difference between the weight of something that's stationary versus the weight of something that's moving. When we turned on the beater with all this moving water,
uh-huh.
it was the vibration, you could feel it.
Okay.
It was so powerful that the floors were going like this. And
mm-hmm.
even though, of course, I checked with the landlord to make sure it could carry that load, a stationary load is very different than moving water. So called up some more engineers, and they said, oh boy, you better turn it off immediately, because just a few blocks away, we had had a similar problem with a different client, and they went through five floors down to the basement.
Oh, wow.
So we had to stop everything and rebrace all the flooring and stuff so that it
uh-huh.
could handle it. Anyway, so you find out those things, but the hard way. And but Canal Street was very nearby,
uh-huh.
and we were always inventing new techniques of doing things,
mm-hmm.
and it was great to go to the Bowery and to go to Canal Street and to get a spaghetti restaurant's size spaghetti strainers to strain our pulp. I mean, that would have been hard to find in Madison, for example. It wouldn't have even occurred to us, really. So it was actually really great to be in New York. And then also in terms of finding fiber, because Walter had said it has to be out of rag. So we were lucky because we could go to the garment district and go through. We tested, you know, there are so many names for shirting, for diaper cotton, for, you know, there are all these different kinds of linen and flax. Oh my God, that's even bigger. So we tested all these different types of cuttings and fibers, and that's because we were in New York also. So
mm-hmm.
that was great. So it was it was definitely an adventure, and it was such an odd thing that Arlene Francis, who I'm sure you aren't familiar with that name, but she was a famous interviewer way back when, and she was working for Voice of America. Do you know what that was? It was an anti-communist radio program that was broadcast into communist countries about how great America, you know, all these different things. So she interviewed me about hand paper, contemporary hand paper. So I kept on thinking, gosh, you know, I'm sure these people in communist countries want to learn something other than how to make a sheet of paper by hand. It seemed like such an odd thing. But at any rate, so we were definitely a novelty. And then it started to catch on. And the thing that really changed things for us is when my dear colleague, Ken Tyler, who I could go on with stories about him and how he reinvented and revolutionized all printmaking in the United States in the 20th century. And he figured out that the paper aspect was really interesting. And he took Robert Rauschenberg to an old mill in France, and they created some of the first handmade paper art of contemporary artists. And those are wonderful stories. Anyway, and then after that, the other artists of that stature were saying, this is kind of interesting. And then he got David Hockney involved, and for 40 days and for 40 nights, he wouldn't let David Hockney go back to England. He made him work in paper pulp, making these huge pools. I don't know if you know David Hockney's work, but it's often, or at least for a period of time, when he was in California, it was all about California pools. And they're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. And of course, it's a water medium, and he was making this pool-type imagery. And just like, boom, immediately people got it. And our phone was off the hook, and you know, the rest was history, so to speak.
Well, that's great. Can you talk a little bit too about the time period, like when you moved to New York, and then also kind of what was happening elsewhere in New York City, like the Studio 54 visits, that kind of thing?
Well, I'll start in Madison. I had a great group, a very creative group of friends, and I had my MFA show with Jody Shields, and we had so many multi-talented friends, not just from the art department, but from actually Far Eastern studies. A lot of our friends were Buddhists and were really, you know, cool Buddhists. And so we had a big show that we put together as part of our MFA show. It wasn't just the artwork, it was actually a big party, and we composed all this music, and we had a band and singers and dancers, and we had this big, it was open to everybody, this big party. So that's kind of how my group was. And we used to do collaborative art pieces too that were just done for the fun of it, that were very, very interesting. So when I went to New York, I was the first of this group, and all these different friends would stay in, like we had what's called the beater room. It's a soundproof room so that you don't have to hear the beater, and the beater hadn't been built yet, so people would, it was very quiet, so people would come and stay in the beater room, but different people would come through, and that whole sense of working hard and playing hard definitely came to New York. To the point where, because we would go out dancing every single night to Studio 54 until the wee hours, until 4 in the morning, so we wouldn't get it together until 11 o'clock or whatever the next day. And, you know, by the time we got our orders together, this is for building the studio, our lumber orders, it was too late to get the wood that day because we hadn't gotten the order in. And then we'd go out dancing until the wee hours, and then it would happen again. But we would do things like Andrew Ginzel, who was wonderful at helping us build the studio, is now quite a famous artist himself. We used to jump on our bicycles when we get back from dancing, bicycle down to the Fulton Fish Market at 4 in the morning and get lobsters for everybody, bring them back, put them in, the lobsters into the papermaking vats, and then And then the day would start at whatever time, noon, and we'd work. And then we'd have a big dinner party with the lobsters and then go out dancing again. So there were a lot of clubs, CBGBs, you know, the Ramones, who, you know, all these people were, it was a very creative time. And, you know, why not be a part of it?
And that was around 1976?
Yes. Yeah, very Andy cool. Warhol, yeah, the whole, I remember meeting him a number of times.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Just meeting him. I mean, you know, he looked exactly what you would think he looked like and was as obscure as you would think he would be. I certainly didn't hang around the factory or anything like that. But but it was really interesting. And all kinds of artists were coming and going. I don't know if you know, like Roy Lichtenstein and his sister-in-law lived downstairs. And so there, and just getting exposed to, you know, the extraordinary talent that, that flows in and out of New York all the time, it still is a great experience. It really is.
Well, Sue, I know that Paul Wong wasn't part of Dudonné initially, but he did come aboard. Can you talk? And he's been there for a long time. I think he's, is he leaving now?
He's recently retired, although he comes back to do to work on a contract basis with certain artists because he's so talented, so insanely talented, and so generous. He and Ruth are absolutely sterling examples of what Madison has produced in terms of truly great, and Joe Wilfer too, truly great collaborators. And to be a great collaborator, it means that you have to be as talented as any artist that you're working with, and these are the, you know, the best of the best, as talented and as disciplined, but with a willingness and actually a real joy in sharing what you have to offer in collaboration. I mean, everybody needs credit, but obviously you're not signing your name to that work of art. So it takes a very special kind of person to be able to do that. And Paul's definitely one of those people. And he was, everyone knew how talented he was out when we were out here. So when I had started Dudonné and it was up and going, and Paul was deciding what to do, I said, Paul, would you like to come out? And even though lithography was more of his field of expertise, you might say, you know, it's very easy to teach Paul a few things, and then he's, you know, on his way. So he has worked with hundreds and hundreds of artists, and he, as I said, he's kind of a perfect collaborator. He knows just what to do when.
And you mentioned Ruth too. Could you talk a little bit? I know that Dudonné and Pace have worked on projects together. Can you talk a little bit about that relationship?
Sure. Well, Joe actually was, Joe Wilfer came out, and he was the director of Skowhegan, which is a painting residency program. And then when he stopped doing that, he wanted to get back into working with artists in some kind of collaborative way. And so Joe and I talked about him working at Dudonné, not as an employee, but as a kind of co-collaborator on certain projects. And so that's how we got started, and that was great. And then Joe eventually took those collaborations and worked directly with Dick Solomon of Pace, and Dudonné continued on, we continued on ours. And then eventually, you know, Ruth came out and started working with Joe, and she was his, Joe's protege. And she's multi-talented in, you know, printing as well as papermaking or whatever, all of the above. You know, so she was great. And then when Joe passed away, she was really the natural person to follow in his lead and become the leader for those particular kinds of collaborations. But then over the years, because we all, you know, came from the same place and had lots of mutual friends, and I keep on going back to the sandbox, we're pretty good about playing together in a collaborative way. And And Dick Solomon, very smart guy, who's head of Pace Prince.
Mm-hmm.
I think he always recognized that we work really well together, and so at various times, Dick would be the publisher. The work would be done at Udinay, but with Pace people, which would include Joe or Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
And so different projects, whether it's with Chuck or Donald Batchelor or other artists, would either be at Udinay in a combination of, people from both organizations. I would say most of the work not, but certainly a lot of crossover.
Mm-hmm.
And various people that have worked at Udinay have gone on to work at Pace in different capacities.
Okay.
One of our wonderful collaborators is now the head of Pace Prince.
Okay.
And she was, actually, she helped me out a lot with some William Kentridge projects. And, she was the person in the rubber boots and the apron. And now she's the sophisticated salesperson at Pace Prince. So
okay.
It's very organic process.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Can you talk a little bit about your teaching? Because I know you've taught papermaking at the New School and Rutgers and elsewhere. Can you talk a little bit about those experiences and how you teach paper?
Well,
papermaking.
Yeah. It's very natural to
mm-hmm.
use papermaking as an educational tool in so
mm-hmm.
many different ways. I'll first say that initially, when I started Udinay, I was thinking about professional artists. I
mm-hmm.
wasn't thinking about teaching, per se. And then this really wonderful English woman came in, who's an artist herself, but she taught kindergarten to American kids. And she said, I'd love to bring my kindergarten class here. And I just was horrified at the thought of it, mainly because of how dangerous the equipment can be and,
uh-huh.
just keeping on track of little kids in that way. So it was very discouraging, and she was very charming, and she had this great English accent. So I said, okay, bring them over. And of course, they were great, and they, were natural at it, and they were so engaged that there wasn't any problem with, kids acting up or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They were perfect, and I thought, this is pretty cool. So then when the New School came to us and said, would you teach this, and can you teach it at your shop? Because obviously we're not going to set up a papermaking studio. We said, that's fine. And then, we established actually one of the first university curriculums for, basic papermaking. And that's always fun, too. And I have taught, and I've taught kids, and I'm, every age group, it seems like. And it's great. It's very basic. I have to say the thing that I always enjoy it. And I try and bring some of the great lessons that I learned from Walter
mm-hmm.
To my teaching, which is if I have a semester-long class, it's not a workshop or whatever, then I do try and get them to write research papers on some aspect, because I think it's just a great exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And I also try and get students to present their work as an oral exam,
mm-hmm.
Not just a critique, but actually try and speak eloquently and clearly about their work, because I would say more times than not, I think that, and this is probably natural, that visual artists do not communicate in words as well,
mm-hmm.
and it's always helpful when they do. Certainly William Kentridge is a case in point. Actually, Chuck Close, I remember going to his lectures when I first knew him, when he was in his 30s and I was in my 20s, I guess, I don't know. And he was really pretty stiff, and they were kind of intellectual in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then so many things happened, like pre his health issues versus after his health issues. There's a real divide there in all aspects of his life and art making. And one of the things that I really noticed is he just started talking about his work in a much more natural way, talking about, and now you can go online and hear these things, of course, but talking about his grandmother and how important her crocheting, or I can't remember, knitting, whatever it was, that how important it was to his seeing the world the way he does. And I think that's what's so real.
Mm-hmm.
William Kentridge is another person who, well, he's kind of brilliant. Go online, watch his movies. They really are just, oh my God. But he, I remember going to one lecture, and he was explaining, he was talking about how he's very interested in when humans can identify something and when they, when they're not able to identify something, what, how that happens. And so because he also makes movies, he draws them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What he did is he said, and he's also taught children, and he's taught, you know, printmaking classes, all kinds of things. So he started explaining it, and then he, all of a sudden he pulls up on the screen this movie, and he said, for example, and you just see his hands doing this, and he's talking, and the hands are tearing up black construction paper. And he said, you know, if you tear up a bunch of construction paper for kids, and they love to tear up paper anyway, and they said, no, I can't draw, I can't, everyone's, I can't draw. So he said, don't worry about it, tear up this paper, they all tear it up, and then move it around until you find something. And then you watch his hands on the screen, and he's moving around these black pieces of construction paper. And all of a sudden you see a black cat that's, you know, arched up with the tail and stuff. And you go, oh my gosh. And he said, that's what I'm interested in, is when it goes from being just some black pieces of paper to something you recognize. And then he showed how, like, how with these same sheets of paper, and his hands are just moving them around, how you go from, you see a horse and it's walking, and then a horse and it's running, and then a horse and it's gallop, really galloping,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden you can't recognize it anymore as a horse. It's gone. And so people like that who, because it's always better to show rather than tell, and but you can show through words.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'm going on and on to way too much, but I do try and help students understand that it's very important to communicate in a number of different ways. But the thing that I'm most interested in, of course, is collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
I really, it's playing. And I think I mentioned before that the, and I didn't bring any examples of this, but right now I'm working with a Danish artist who has lived in India for 18 years. And she helped organize a Tagore centennial celebration, the
mm-hmm.
poet Tagore. And he's kind of the Shakespeare of India. So the poem that we're working with has to do with the word play, which is Kerala. And all art really is play.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you go back and quote, I didn't know this was Picasso, but then someone said that, Picasso said that, that we're born artists and then we're taught not to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so much problem solving, to come around full circle, is really just play. It's just playing and playing and playing. Oh, there it is. That's the right way. That's the solution. That's the one that will work for this particular problem. So the work that I'm doing right now are making some watermarks of Kama Sutra images in watermark
mm-hmm.
to this poem.
Well,
which
sounds
is,
really interesting.
It is. It's fun. And we're using, they're called Jali patterns, which are, they're the intricate stone patterns, beautiful patterns that you see all over India. And they're used for railings, but they're also used not for shutters, but for screen, kind of screens that cover windows. And it's traditionally women were not supposed to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're behind, you know, they're up on a balcony looking through these jelly, beautiful jelly patterns. But they're also for air circulation, because then you have privacy, but at the same time, you have the buildings are open
mm-hmm.
so that the air is circulating. So we're having jelly patterns that cover the Kama Sutra watermarks. And then it's like, oh, that's what's going on behind this jelly. But actually, it's really tied into this amazing poem that,
mm-hmm.
you know, anyway.
Well, so actually, that brings up something that I wanted to ask you. How do you find people to collaborate with? Like, how did you find this artist?
It's more like, how do I mean, right now, it's like looking out at a airport landing field, you know. Mm-hmm. There are so many projects that you can see the airplane, and then you can see the lights, and then you see this little dim light behind. That's how many projects I have lined up right now. And it's just meeting interesting people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The latest example, and I really, when I say there are so many projects lined up, is Andrea Dezo, D-E-Z-S-O. She's Transylvanian.
Mm-hmm.
You can go online and look her up. God, she's brilliant. I was interested in tunnel books. And another friend of mine who I met here, who's a book artist, I can go on about him. Anyway, he organized a book conference in Massachusetts near Amherst, near all the book people that are out there. And he said, do you want to take one of the classes? And I said, yeah. And there are all these bookbinding, blah, blah, blah. But I've been curious about tunnel books for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, Andrea is teaching tunnel books. Well, I kind of had an idea, and you know, you always have assumptions. I had an idea of what it was all about. And then I took her class, and she's just a genius. She's just brilliant, like so brilliant and so wonderful. And she has a Transylvanian accent that's so fascinating. So the whole combination. So I learned this little bit about her. Then I got really curious. And then I asked her, and then she said, oh, well, you know, go online. You can see some of the big projects that she's, because she's done all this, you know, work for the New York City subway system. They have artists in the subways. And so she's done stuff on huge scales. And by every turn, it's like, wow, this is fascinating. And I've bought a couple copies of the book that she, newest version of Grimm's Fairy Tales that she illustrated, that are kind of like cutouts.
Mm-hmm.
She just has this Transylvanian imagination that is so wonderful. So I can't wait to start on a project with her. You know, you get excited. But that also happens with poets too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, oh, let me show you real quick. So I also brought this, just because I haven't had it handy.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, I can't remember if I talked about him or not, but Mark Strand.
You did talk about Mark Strand.
This is the, you know, poet laureate of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
If you go online, probably the most handsome poet that ever walked the planet. Really, I shouldn't say that. But everyone knew him. And graceful, not only just, you know, physically handsome, uh-huh. And charming, but just this grace. I don't think I've ever met anyone with this kind of grace. So this is a drawing that he actually gave me that
mm-hmm.
we then photographed and made into a plate. And this is the handmade paper. And so what happened is the first... the first time I worked with him, maybe I mentioned this, is that I was working with a Catalan artist, Frederic Amat, and Robert Wilson, the performance artist. They were the two artists. And then we were talking about, okay, you know, so whose poetry do we want to work with? And Frederic knew Mark and said, you know, I really like Mark's stuff, and let me send you some poems. So he sent them over, and I said, oh, God, those are perfect. So then we chose one. And he said, Sue, you know, Mark's teaching at Columbia. You really should meet each other. Did I tell you this whole story already?
I know that you talked about, we talked about color theory. And
yes,
good,
okay, and Joseph Albers. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So I did tell you. So he came down to Giudice, and I thought he was a poet, you know, and I didn't Google him like an idiot. And then, you know, years later, I finally go, why do you have such a great sense of color? Because he helped do all the color theory books with his, and Eva Hesse, who's this amazing artist, that was his girlfriend. Anyway, you know, he's, so this is what we did when he passed away. He and I were working on a new book. He passed
mm-hmm.
away, the idea for a new book.
Mm-hmm.
He passed away. And so his partner, Mary Cruz, and
mm-hmm.
And his daughter, Jessica, and I said, well, let's do a version of it. So we took the same artist, or poet, excuse me, and we asked them to pick their favorite poem of Mark's and then
mm-hmm.
write something about it. So we had a bunch of samples of what he did to make collages.
Mm-hmm.
So when he would come in to work with me, he would just play like a kid with these colors. And then he would go back and cut them up and make them into collages. And so each book has a completely different sample, rather.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And well,
how many did you make?
There are 50 in the edition.
Okay.
And again, I can't help myself using translucent, and although this is abaca and this is cotton.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was great. I mean, this is a Nobel laureate. These are all kind of amazing writers and poets.
Actually, could you read some of them? They're pretty famous.
Okay. Joseph Brodsky, Louise Gluck, Jory Graham, William Merwin, Vijay, really bad at names. How would you say his last name? And he's a really sweet guy, too.
I'm not sure, but Seshadri?
That sounds right. He's very sweet. If this ever comes out. Charles Simic, Derek Walcott, Rosanna Warren, and Charles Wright. And I'm not the only one on the planet who loved Mark and loves him.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this guy, everyone loved this man. So everyone was delighted to participate in some way. And we couldn't get it, because it's just complicated trying to get everybody to do everything. So those are the artists. And then Mark drew as well. So these are I went through a whole box of drawings that he'd done. Very often landscapes in Nova Scotia, and pulled together the ones that I felt kind of came together as a group.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so these different poets would pick out their favorite of Mark's, and then they would respond to the poem. This is his response. And some of them are so touching that that's the other part. When you're working on books, I don't know how other people talk about this, but you know, there's always in any kind of collaboration, there are points where you just are pulling your hair out, going nuts, and swearing at this person or that person or whatever. But I find not just the art, but more the text. Usually I'm working with poetry. I can go back to the poetry as like this grounding cornerstone, and it always calms me down, and I remember, yes, this is why I'm working as hard as I am, because this is really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great to be able to do that. And then you can see these. It's a similar, I'm afraid I've gotten stuck in my formula. Not exactly, but it's a formula
And as you're turning the pages here, the images are on the transparent paper,
mm-hmm.
and you can see the words kind of poking through.
Coming through,
mm-hmm.
right. And then you can also see it's transparent enough, not transparent, but translucent enough that you can still
mm-hmm.
Kind of get a sense of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it also, this whole sense of space, and horizon, Mark's poetry, and he as a person himself was like that. and that's part of his grace, I think. There was always so much space. You were never crowded in. You're never crowded in by ego. You're never crowded in by nervous energy or something that would take away from the openness that
mm-hmm.
you could contribute to whatever it was, and that's what these poems are about. So, yeah, and it was really, this again, this was a very different kind of project for me,
mm-hmm.
but all the poets were just lovely, lovely.
And how did you find the poets to contribute?
Which ones?
Yes.
Well, Mark had mentioned to me the certain poems that he was very interested in, you know, and the poets. And then also Mary Cruz and Jessica also
mm-hmm.
were familiar with what he was thinking about
mm-hmm.
at this. And so we were able to pool our notes. And then Mary Cruz in particular was great about contacting everyone and the publishers. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of a nightmare to do all that. And we don't have all the signatures because Joseph Brodsky passed away.
Okay.
And William Merwin is not well, and he's blind. So, yeah, but we got as many as we could.
That's great.
Yeah, so that's that. It's, you know, pretty simple, but it's a very gratifying project. So
Sue, you told me last time, I think off the recording, that you founded Dudonné, and then you eventually kind of stepped back from your role, your initial role, and I know you're, and still are, on the board of directors. Can you talk a little bit about how your role there changed, and then what you kind of pursued as you stepped back from that organization?
Sure. Well, first I co-founded it with my ex-husband, Bruce Weinberg. And then when we split up, that's when I asked Paul to come out. And then Paul and I were busy trying to spread the word of hand paper making for quite a while. And then after that, by 1987, I was really, I was married by then, remarried, and I'd had my first child. So, okay. So then I had my first kid, and I realized this is too complicated. So then, and another thing was going on in 1987, because I had founded it as a for-profit, and we were actually able to get grants, even though we were for-profit, to do all kinds of things. And we really needed that research income, because we were doing a lot of things that hadn't been done before, to be honest. And so by 1987, the tax laws had changed, all kinds of things had changed, and I realized that we really needed to have a not-for-profit status so that we could get grants for various, our educational program was up and running, all kinds of things were happening. And I needed to be able to focus on my family, and so I brought in our first executive director. Changed the status to not-for-profit, and that's when I changed it to two corporations. One is Dudonné Press, and one is Dudonné Paper Mill. But I still stayed involved with Dudonné Paper Mill, but in a much more passive way. And then, so what happened next? Okay, one executive director, then another one. Things were still growing organically. And then by the time we got to... what year was that? 15 years later. Okay, yeah, I guess about 1990. Really, it had grown quite a bit. We had done another move, and I did get more involved. It really depended on where my kids were at that point.
Sure.
And I was still a little, you know, not as much as I am now, but I was still also publishing books too. And then, you know, by the time my kids were older, I was able to really re-engage again, both definitely in the book projects, but now more recently in helping Dudonné with our next growth spurt, which, oh my God, how many more of these? I think this would be my last one. But we've gone from one studio to three studios. So we really do have pretty defined programs in different ways, and I can't remember if I mentioned this or not, but that a number of weeks ago when we had a Brooklyn crawl and we went to, as part of the IPCNY exhibition, we had events, and we went to Pace, to their studio that Ruth has just, so we went to Pace, and we saw what Ruth has been doing, and then we went to Dudonné, and just kind of going, I don't know, there was something about going to the two places, boom, boom, in that context. Pace, you know, they've done just unbelievable work with incredible artists, and continue to do so, and will continue to do so. But it really was a very simple, kind of clear focus of making the art, these collaborations. Whereas Dudonné has morphed, you know, so that simple class with the kindergarten students has become this whole educational program with lots of funding. And we have residencies where we get funding to allow artists to come in and work. We have publishing that's closer to PACE so that we initiate that kind of art making. And then we have a community studio that where we provide instruction and some support help for artists to come in and make their own work. We have our own gallery. We have, it's like, it's almost, you know, that's when all of a sudden I realized, oh my gosh, you know, we have these institutional type programs. And so we are in the next stage, and I'm working on the new strategic plan for the next few years to fulfill the potential of, it's really the physicality of those three studios, making sure that we have the right people to conduct all the programs.
And where are the three studios?
They're all together at Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what is it like for you to see this thing that you started in 1976 turn into this large organization with all this programming?
Well, at least 10 years ago, I thought, oh, this is really wonderful, you know, all these things that it's grown into. Right now, I kind of feel like, fine, great, go grow, keep on growing, do whatever you want to do. I just want to get back to my book projects.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, I'm, yeah, of course, I'm very pleased. It's great. And I'm, and it's been fun. It's been, you know, this amazing thing. I didn't quite realize this at first, but at a certain point, I realized it, and then now I feel there is some real truth to it, that it picked me, I didn't pick it. And perhaps the fact that I come from the Paper Valley in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, that I come from Wisconsin, I don't know. You know, it's like, okay, that one will work hard to keep, you know, to develop this craft into an art form. And because it's certainly not a job, it's a calling.
Mm-hmm. And what about your press? You said you have a lot of projects in the works,
mm-hmm.
and things that you're very interested in getting to. How many books a year are you doing? Because you said that they're quite time intensive.
Yes, they are. Let's see, right now I have, three that are in different stages of,
mm-hmm.
of completion, and one that is just starting to get, you know, come together as an
mm-hmm.
idea. Yeah, and I, you know, it's very organic. It's not like I say, well, I want to do X number of books a year and blah, blah,
sure.
blah. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I could see all of that changing in other ways. For example, one of the things after doing these books for a while, it's a limited audience in the sense, or limited collectors and limited audience, because people usually like to look at visual work on the wall,
mm-hmm.
and they usually like to hold a book in their lap. And this is, you know, so rarefied, you have to go to a special collections, and so that's kind of annoying in a certain way. And so I might try and rethink that model in
mm-hmm.
some way. Although I do love them, I really do. So we'll see. Or I might want to think of designing one so that there could be a kind of a trade edition or a commercial edition
oh,
that
sure.
could come out of it. And that you have to think of that ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'd like to do something like that. Yeah.
And I'm curious with all of your work over the years, have any of your family members kind of become interested in this? Have you worked with them on any projects?
Well, people usually run away from me because they know it's like, here she comes, whether it's old friends or whatever. Oh, you, well, right now, my middle son, who runs a gallery in Brooklyn, is helping to do install and deinstall some of the gallery exhibitions.
Uh-huh.
And, well, and actually, that was also an organic process where, anyway, I kind of pulled him, and I pull him in periodically. My youngest son is an architect, and he's doing the drawings for, we're redoing the gallery and the lighting and stuff like that. So, yeah, so they kind of, that's what I mean, they run the other direction.
But they're involved in different ways, though.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
What about, as we're looking to wrap things up, do you have any final thoughts in general or specifically about how the UW influenced you?
Oh, it defined my career. There's no question about that. The only thing I can say is that when you have a good thing going, don't pull the funds out, you know. The reason why, you know, there are different phases in at different times, certainly. And I don't know what it's like now, but the art department, especially the printmaking department, was just on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And you usually have that happen because you have teachers who are on fire.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have one will serve to attract another. And the only thing that I could recommend to a university is make sure you recognize when you have someone like that, that you really support them and that you help them bring more people and then give them as much freedom and support as possible, because they'll attract great graduate students. I mean, it's, you know, it's simple. It's
mm-hmm.
really simple. So, yeah, that's you know, because I do think in noticing friends of mine in particular who really have stayed in academia,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, there's all the bureaucracy of academia, and it can small down a big person,
mm-hmm.
a big spirit, and you don't want that to happen. Yeah, I'm thinking of one friend who's teaching at the University of the Arts right now, and she's just such a spitfire. Boy, she's bringing in this energy, and she's, you know, all the students are coming. It's like, you know, they're just going right to her.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the people, always.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you'd like to add?
No.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.